Blog Talk Radio.
Break free from the fear. Pierce the dark and narrow of mystery with ISIS Paranormal Radio.
Hello, Mary Meat, and welcome to ISIS Paranormal Radio, where we urge you to break free from the fear and to pierce the darkened veil of mystery. I'm Dana Winters.
And I'm Patricia Gardner, and we're your hosts for tonight's show. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of ISIS Paranormal Radio. Last night, we interviewed Dan Green about his movie, The Murder of Mary Magdalene, Genocide of the Holy Bloodline. We talked with him about his research, the challenges he faced, and the different evidence suggesting the possible murder of Mary Magdalene. If you missed the show, check out our archives on blogtalkradio.com/ISIS Paranormal.
For tonight's guest, we will be talking with author Stephen Myers. Stephen is an independent researcher, a lecturer, and an author who has studied the Great Pyramid. He has worked toward understanding how the pyramids were built and why. Stephen's research has included travel to Egypt in order to conduct on-site research at the Giza Plateau, and he has written numerous articles for magazines, has given lectures about the Great Pyramid, and he has compiled his research in order to write Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, How the Great Pyramid Was Built. In his book, he provides a comprehensive and detailed explanation of how the Great Pyramid was constructed, and he argues that advanced technologies were used to build the structure.
Stephen Myers is the founder of a nonprofit foundation which is dedicated to exploring and explaining how the Great Pyramid was built. The foundation has been established in the hopes of redeveloping the ancient and advanced technologies used on the pyramids to help our modern troubled world. We have Stephen on the line with us, and we're going to take a moment to welcome him to the show. Welcome.
Yes, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's a wonderful opportunity for me.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight, and we're very eager to talk to you about your research and your book. And I'm going to let Pat start with the questions. Pat?
Cool. First, can you tell us more about yourself, where you're from, and what you like to do in your free time?
Well, I don't really have free time anymore. I'm the founder of a nonprofit foundation, which is headquartered out here in Oregon, and we are studying the lost technologies of the Great Pyramid. We're trying to find out how the Great Pyramid was actually built and redevelop these ancient technologies to help our modern but very troubled world.
And what got you interested in the Great Pyramid?
Well, I've been interested in history. I enjoy history, that type of thing. But I also like technology. So I collect antique gasoline engines as a hobby, and I'm an amateur radio operator, among other things. So even my hobbies are quite technical, and of course, the foundation is of a very technical nature. But anyway, if you like technology and you like history, ultimately your focus will be on the Great Pyramid, which is a 45-story skyscraper built by ancient mankind.
And a lot of questions surround how that was built, and your book addresses this, correct?
Yes, that's the focus of that book.
Now, can you talk about some of the common theories that people suggest what the Great Pyramid is before we get into what your theories involve?
Well, there's a number of theories. Certainly, what is common has changed throughout the centuries. Herodotus spoke in his book that he was told by the ancient priests that it was built level by level, and they used machines that incorporated short wooden planks. Currently, the conventional thought is that there was a great big ramp, and these many big heavy stones were moved up this ramp, and it was assembled using brute force and back muscles.
Wow. Now, there are some theories that suggest that slaves were used to build these pyramids. And then I recently watched a show where they're saying it wasn't slaves, it was friends of the king. Is that correct?
It doesn't matter let me put it this way. The focus of our research is not who did it, nor their political status of who did it, but how it was done. It's immaterial if they were free men or if they were slaves. What is important is the processes that they did to accomplish the construction of the Great Pyramid.
Very good. Thank you. Pat?
Let me make an example.
Oh, okay.
There was an old, during the slave years in the United States, they had a cotton gin, which was a machine, a technical machine, that somebody turned the crank and it separated the seeds, the cotton seeds, from the cotton fiber. How the cotton gin worked is immaterial to whether or not it was a free man or a slave cranking the crank. So,
right.
So that's what we're concerned with, the technology more than who did it.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Pat?
Can you tell us about the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation?
Correct. Yes. The Pharaoh's Pump Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit foundation recognized by the federal government, and we are dedicated to understanding the Great Pyramid, and specifically how it was built and why it was built. And we are, like I say, out here in Oregon, we're funded by mainly by private donations, but we certainly need a sponsor. We're trying to redevelop these ancient technologies and be able to use them to help our modern world.
And how many years has your foundation been researching the pyramids, or just you researching them?
Well, I was interested in the Great Pyramid, and I read the conventional books written by Egyptologists, and I learned something about those books, and that is the methods that they say the Great Pyramid was built have not been demonstrated. They've never been demonstrated, so I went to other books, unconventional books about people humming and floating the stones and that type of thing. Well, ultimately, they would hum, and the stones, these heavy 70-ton stones, would move around and that type of thing. Well, that, I didn't really go for that either, but there was a book, a privately published book by a fellow named Edward Kunkel, who felt that the Great Pyramid was built using water locks and water, and that book is we named our foundation in honor of his book, which is called Pharaoh's Pump. And so that's about our foundation.
That's pretty cool. Pat?
How is the foundation? Oh, you already said that. Never mind.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of findings are suggested for your research?
Well, what we think is that the Great Pyramid was built using the buoyancy of water and water locks. So there's a lot of physical evidence that supports that. The casing stones, those finely made stones that are very precise, that the Great Pyramid used to be covered in, they were cemented together and watertight. And we felt that was to hold water inside the structure. And Herodotus spoke a lot about water on the Giza Plateau, canals from an ancient lake Maurice to the Giza area, that type of thing. And the early researchers in the last century, specifically Flanders Petrie, he found what was called Nile earth inside the Great Pyramid, but which was sediment.
Uh-huh.
So there's just a whole host of evidences that indicate that water was a important factor in the construction and purpose of the Great Pyramid.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the inside of the Great Pyramid, what it's like, and how it would fit into your theory?
Yes. The inside is awesome. If anyone ever gets a chance to go to Egypt, you can tour inside it, and it's just phenomenal. Some of the early explorers said that they felt like they were inside of a machine, and it certainly doesn't look like a tomb to hold treasure and a mummy, because there's multiple chambers and multiple passages that go all through the Great Pyramid. And the Pharaoh, he only had one soul. So, you know, it doesn't really fit the explanation of the Great Pyramid being a tomb. But we felt that it was infrastructure, that the Great Pyramid was constructed using water locks, like the Panama Canal, and that it served a purpose of being infrastructure, and that infrastructure was to pump water.
That's awesome. And how does your findings differ from other arguments about the pyramids or how they were built? I mean, you mentioned some of them, but there are a lot of different theories.
Okay, there's a lot of theories. Primarily, the primary theory in modern times is that this great big ramp was used, but Egypt, the science of Egyptology has never moved a full-sized largest stones that are 70 tons. They've never moved a payload of that weight even 1 inch.
And why do you think they haven't conducted experiments to try to figure out
That's an easy question, because the way they say it was built is an impossibility. It cannot be done that way. Egyptology has never made a casing stone to the precision of the originals the way they say it was done. In all the books, in all the libraries in the world, they say that it was done just by using hand tools to create extreme precision. Well, it can't be done, and that's why they don't demonstrate it. Because they are fundamentally incorrect.
There's nowhere in the world right now where they're trying to experiment to determine how this was done?
Since the inception of Egyptology, they have never even made one surface of one casing stone to show how it was done.
That seems kind of criminal.
Yes. it's a science that does not engage in the scientific method.
Wow.
Yes, it's interesting. None of their books talk about that it's never been demonstrated. They've never even moved a heavy stone around the corner of a spiral ramp.
Wow.
So, yes, Egyptology has become the phrenology of the 21st century. Phrenology was the science that they would feel that your skull and the bumps on your head corresponding to your psychosis or whatever.
Right. Yep.
The reason why that science has failed to prosper and has ceased to exist is because it cannot be supported by the scientific method. Egyptology is next.
Wow. Pat? Go ahead.
Go ahead. What we're trying to do is give glory to the ancient geniuses who built the Great Pyramid. Not say that that ancient mankind was a bunch of knuckle draggers dragging stones up a ramp using back muscles. It's just hooey that what Egyptologists say.
Yeah, and I've read some books on Egyptology where they suggest that the Egyptian people were almost kind of savage and that they didn't hold these kind of intelligences. I just don't believe that. I mean, look at what they accomplished. I just don't believe that.
Absolutely. There is certainly ancient times is much different than what Egyptology has told us. That's for sure.
Wow. Thank you. Pat?
So what about the argument that the pyramids are aligned with certain star constellations? Does this contradict your theory, or does it work with it?
There are some vents in the Great Pyramid that point to stars. And we feel that the Great Pyramid was a water pump. And there doesn't seem like the vents should point to stars if it's a technological device. Yet, everything that points up points to stars. The pencils in my pencil cup, the Statue of Liberty wears a crown with 7 points. Those 7 points all point to stars. If it points up, it's going to point to stars. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So you think it's more coincidental?
There is a correlation, certainly, between the vents and stars, but is there a causation? Is there any way to show that there's a purpose for that. And what the people that talk about that correlation, they say, well, the Book of the Dead mentions some stars and that type of thing. Well, what does the Book of the Dead have to do with the Great Pyramid? Well, there's no Book of the Dead in the Great Pyramid. There's no writings of the Book of the Dead, no hieroglyphs, but they have kind of a tenuous justification for this star-vent relationship. Also, the stars in the sky move across the sky because of the precession of the equinoxes. So those vents don't point to those stars now. They point to other stars. So who's to say that they didn't build the Great Pyramid to commemorate another time with different stars? So what we try to do at our foundation is start with a clean slate, try to understand how that structure was built and how it was assembled, and also its purpose, instead of just looking at the Great Pyramid and trying to see its symbolic significance. Do you understand the difference?
Right. Absolutely. Now, I know you're not concerned with who necessarily built the pyramids, and you're more focused on how they were built, but do you have any concern in your research as to why the Great Pyramid would be built as a water pump and how
it
would benefit?
Yeah, that's the focus of our research, is to redevelop this ancient technology. We think that all of those passages and chambers, when originally built, worked as a water pump and pumped water out of the King's Chamber's vents and ultimately to the point of use. And the original builders, the geniuses who built the Great Pyramid, wanted to transform the desert into a garden. They wanted to transform their own civilization from poverty to prosperity, and that's what this infrastructure did for them. They were able to pump the water and use it for any number of purposes, probably power heavy machinery of some kind, and also to keep their bellies full by having crops, and a whole host of other purposes. I see the Giza Plateau more as an industrial park than I do as a graveyard.
Very good. Now, in your book, you also mentioned that some people believe that there was a capstone on the pyramids and some people don't. Can you talk about that? And what is your belief? Was there a capstone there? And if so, what was it used for?
Well, the capstone certainly is the stone on the very top. But actually, in the early writings, there's not much said about that, whether it had one or not. But it's hard to say. You know, there's no surviving physical evidence to indicate that there was one or not. But if there was, it would have been brought up the side of the Great Pyramid in water locks and put on the top of the Great Pyramid. I don't see it as any symbolic thing or any type of biblical prophecy or anything like that. So it's just a component of a building, the capstone.
Very good. Thank you, Pat.
What specific challenges did the Egyptians face when building the pyramids?
Well, they had a challenge that they understood that they couldn't do it by hand. They couldn't create the extreme precision or move the massive stones by hand. It simply couldn't be done. So what they did was they used something that we don't have in the 21st century. They had something back then that we don't have, and what that was, they had their own genius in their own minds, and that's unavailable to us now. And they understood that they could use water locks from the Nile River all the way up to the building site, and then ultimately move stones, similar to the Erie Canal over there in New York. They could move stones from the Nile River all the way up to the building site and ultimately on barges and set them in place. The Erie Canal moved enough cargo that equaled the weight of the Great Pyramid in 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. What's left of it.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Wow.
It, the water locks are actually a 21st century technology. The Panama Canal is being redeveloped with larger water locks. The reason why they're using water locks is because it's an efficient way to move our heaviest objects that we move, which are big ships. The ancient builders of the Great Pyramid understood that technology and used that same technology to move their heaviest objects.
Now, we don't want to give the whole book away, but can you talk about the assembly process of the Great Pyramid, like some of the steps?
Yes. Imagine on the Giza Plateau that there's no pyramid, nothing built at all, and the first stones set in place were the casing stones of the first level. And that would they're on the outside, so that would make like a square area. And if you would fill that area with water, you'd have a pond, if you will, right on the Giza Plateau, impounded by those casing stones that are cemented together. Well, then imagine water locks from the Nile River all the way up to that pond, and stones on barges, the interior stones on barges, were brought up for that first level, and they were moved from right up into that pond. And then they were moved from the barge into the pond. So when that pond was filled with stones, the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. And then they would put the second level of casing stones around and then add more water to raise the pond up to the second level and then add a water lock to get to that level and then complete the process. So it was a fast, easy way to levitate the stones into place and to construct the Great Pyramid. The Erie Canal was built 4.5 feet deep, and the barges could hold a payload of 70 tons. So that's the weight of the heaviest stones of the Great Pyramid. So with a ditch 4.5 feet deep, you can move the largest stones effortlessly. So it's interesting.
Why would they need a pump that large?
Oh, that's easy. They use that water to irrigate above the floodplain. They would use that water to power heavy machinery. It's interesting. The largest structure in North America is the Grand Coulee Dam, and its primary purpose is to pump water. The largest and most expensive structure built by humans in North America, when built, was a water pump. The largest structure in the Valley of the Nile, the largest structure is the High Aswan Dam. It's a hydroelectric dam, but that water is used to, or excuse me, that electricity it makes is used to pump water. And the Egyptians now grow all kinds of stuff with pumped water. A lot of Egyptian cotton, fruit, vegetables, and everything else. So modern mankind needed a big water pump in the Valley of the Nile. Ancient mankind needed a big water pump in the Valley of the Nile. They operate differently, but they serve the same purposes.
So you think it was for irrigation then?
For certainly for irrigation, but also probably to power heavy machinery. There's a hydraulic air compressor that you can with water compress air, and compressed air can be used to make static electricity. Also, it can be used to make a very hot and a very cold area with a very simple device. For a number of experimental experiments, that type of thing, and any number of things. I know the Middle East is an area of some unusually high technologies, like the Baghdad battery, that type of thing, and other things. So yes, they use it for irrigation, but for any number of purposes, even purposes that we can't imagine yet. But what's important is not what they used it for. What's important is if we can pump water, modern mankind, in an efficient and cheap manner, then we can use that pumped water to irrigate, but also to create electricity and that type of thing. We have to figure out alternative methods for energy to get off of our addiction to oil. So that's what our foundation is about.
Now, there have been recent satellite images that suggest that there was water in certain parts of the desert. Do you think that this irrigation process may have had something to do with the water changing places of where it was? Do you know what I mean? Like it
yes.
was longer in the desert and it was moved to where they wanted it to be? Is that possible?
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. Even the course of the Nile has changed since very distant antiquity in that area. And earlier times, the Nile Valley was more of a savanna than it is now. It's quite a desert, except where it's irrigated by the High Aswan Dam. But yes, they transferred water from one place to another and had an infrastructure that allowed that civilization to thrive.
So do you think all pyramids were used for this purpose or just the Great Pyramid?
All the pyramids in the Nile Valley are built with like different, their sides are of different angles, and they also use different materials. Some are sun-baked mud bricks, and also they have different degrees of precision and quality. Some now are just piles of rubble, if you will. I feel that the Great Pyramid was the only pyramid that was a water pump. Some of the other pyramids could have been copies of the pyramid structure by a later civilization. There's a lot of possibilities. They could have made copies and adapted it, possibly for tombs or other purposes. But the Great Pyramid itself was a large structure with no writing on it, no formal writing, just like a large hydroelectric dam doesn't have any formal writing. And it's 90% solid, just like a hydroelectric dam, with a few passages and enigmatic chambers like a hydroelectric dam, except the dams operate differently as a different type of infrastructure than the Great Pyramid. So that's what we think it was, an infrastructure for a civilization that had geniuses to build this energy-efficient water pump that was non-polluting.
So then what was the purposes of, like, the king's chambers and those passageways inside?
Okay. Before the Great Pyramid was even built, there was a passage built down into the solid bedrock and the subterranean chamber that appears to be unfinished.
Right.
Our research indicates that that was like a hydraulic ram water pump that was able to pump water up to supply water to the water locks during construction. And the king's and the queen's chamber, as well as the grand gallery and associated passages, acted similar to a, and this is getting a little more technical, which is actually what I like, but it acted like a Humphrey pump, which is down in Australia. And that is a pump that uses combustion to create a vacuum in a chamber that draws water up. And then they release the vacuum in that chamber, and that massive, about 100-ton column of water moves down, and then it pumps water up. We feel, not to get too technical, but that the Grand Gallery acted in a very similar way. And when water would move up in the Grand Gallery, then it would be allowed to move back down and push water into the Queen's Chamber, and then ultimately into the King's Chamber, and then out the King's Chamber vents. But the book kind of talks about how the pump is utilized, and it's hard to describe over radio, so that's why I wrote a whole book about it.
It's got some great illustrations in there, too, that make it very clear.
I appreciate that.
I recommend it. Yeah, you did a great job. Pat?
So I have a question. If the pyramid worked so well as a pump and irrigated and turned it all into like an Eden, why doesn't it work anymore?
Good question.
Did they abandon it?
That's a good question. Actually, the sealing stones in the King's Chamber are broken. And we feel, and a lot of researchers feel, that there was some type of a expansion in the King's Chamber that kind of spread the stones apart a little bit and also broke the sealing stones. Other researchers say that there was maybe some type of an explosion in there in ancient times. We feel that a part of the valve system in there broke, and that caused the hydro pressure inside the King's Chamber to kind of split it at its seams. So it is a it's the Great Pyramid offers, you know, direct physical evidence, and that's an explanation of it. So I think that the Great Pyramid broke and they were unable to fix it.
Now, have you ever tried to replicate this, you know, on a large scale or on a small scale to see if it actually works out?
Yes. That's the absolute purpose of our foundation. We're a nonprofit foundation, and we have a facility here at our research center. And it's, you know, has some tooling, that type of thing. And we have built some sub-assemblies and some components in various scales, and have had some wonderful success. And we think that we are certainly on the right track in developing this ancient technology to be used, this water pumping technology, in modern times. Everyone won't have to have a stone pyramid in their backyard. They'll just use chambers made out of polypropylene or plastic, if you will, with some PVC pipes and valves and some other stuff, and be able to generate all the electricity they need. They will be masters of their own energy needs. So instead of relying on energy traders or the oil companies or building massive hydroelectric dams, people will be able to create their own energy. And that's what we're trying to do. Certainly funding's been a struggle, and building a robust and large prototype is probably the most expensive part of our operation, but that's the goal of our foundation, but it's also my personal life quest.
Now, do you think our reliance on electric companies and oil companies and things of that nature serve as an obstacle for further research? I say that because it's kind of like there's more money in treating the disease than there is finding a cure, kind of thing?
Absolutely. I think that it is very detrimental to us as just citizens of the world to have such a concentration of wealth with the energy traders, and to have somehow, for some reason, developed energy systems that are so detrimental to our environment. The thing down there in the Gulf Coast with that oil spill, what a horrific thing, just so we can drive around or whatever, or heat our homes. I mean, that's inappropriate. Also, when I go buy gasoline, this is just a personal thing, but when I go buy gasoline, I euphemistically call it funding the terrorists, because when you buy gasoline, some of the money goes back to the Middle East. You know, the terrorists, they got to buy bullets too.
Yeah.
Now, you know what I'm saying?
I absolutely understand what you're saying. And
So yes, we need to get off of oil. In fact, our former president, George Bush, says that in one of his presidential addresses, says that we are addicted to oil. But the problem was he was an oil man, and he was making money off of it.
Do you think they're not,
you know,
doing
it's just,
because they like that kind of addiction, because it's a monetary gain for them?
Yes, it's a monetary gain for them. You know, we're in a recession or whatever, but actually it's great times for the oil companies or for the energy traders or whatever. They're making money hand over fist. So it's good times for them. And also, I read in a book, I wish I had the quote in front of me, but when the cost of energy quadruples, the standard of living is cut in half.
Wow.
So what we want to do is establish a new way to generate energy that is decentralized, and that's controlled by the people that use the energy, and it will be a burst to the prosperity of our civilization. And it'll be, instead of polluting the world, it's a system that's described in the book that is a clean system, a system that it can be developed, if we can develop it, that can be used by third world countries, and it can be made in cottage industries because it's just passages and chambers that are made out of PVC pipe, valves, and, you know, large plastic containers type of thing. So
now,
that's what we're doing.
As you draw closer to this possibility, do you think that obstacles will be put in your way to make that not happen?
Oh, certainly. In a lot of ways, this is Edward Kunkel first developed this theory and wrote a book in 1962, and people still haven't heard about it. So there is a kind of a wall of silence in the academic world. Certainly, with Egyptologists, they won't even say that it's wrong because they won't even say it. It's kind of bizarre. So So we're having that trouble, certainly because it's very controversial and very unconventional. Funding has been an issue. So if somebody wants to go to our website and find out how they can become involved, that would help. So, it's been difficult, to be honest with you. But now we have the book out. We've done quite a bit of research, and this book is out, and it's really helping get the word out. So things are looking up now.
That's excellent. Pat?
In general sense, how is the community acting in terms of accepting your theories?
Well, the academic community, well, everyone is pursuing their own story, if you will. But Egyptologists, like I say, wall of silence. But how interesting it is, I live here in southwestern Oregon. The local museum found out that I've got this book out and learned about our foundation. They allowed us to have a space in their museum for a display. So that was very generous and open-minded of them. So again, the word's getting out. I'm doing a few lectures, that type of thing. And hopefully, if we can resolve some of our funding constraints, then it'll help us to pursue this research. It was interesting. Nikola Tesla said that he wanted to have electricity go through wires both directions. So he talked to his college professor, and his college professor says, "Oh no, that will never work. That's a continuous motion scheme." Well, he spent 7 years in Europe, never could get funding for alternating current. So he went to the United States, and it took him a while to get hooked up with Westinghouse, who figured out, "Hey, I can make money off of this," and ultimately, alternating current was developed. So, it takes a while, and it's sometimes hard to get things developed. That's why people like Tesla are such heroes, because they were able to transcend the, horrific problems and get their technology developed.
Now, this would, if it was developed, it would be a completely green method of creating electricity? Like, what
yes.
percentage of the project would be green? Because I know you said
something
about PVC pipes.
Yeah, what we think, how we think that, like I say, I mentioned a vacuum was created in the Grand Gallery. We feel that the ancient Egyptians used electricity and the process of electrolysis to separate the oxygen and hydrogen from water. And then they were able to ignite that in an enclosed chamber in the top part of the Grand Gallery. And the result was a vacuum. So there's the ancient builders of the Great Pyramid were already in the hydrogen age that we haven't caught up to yet. So that's what we think.
Wow, that's really wild. Pat?
So how does your research change our current understanding of Egyptian technology?
Well, it's just another example of ancient but very high technology in the Middle East. There are other examples. There's the Baghdad Battery and the Antikythera mechanism that was like a solar clock, if you will, with a bunch of little gears. But also there's other examples of high technology, the extreme precision of the stone cutting, and also the cement that was between the casing stones was extremely strong, characterized as being stronger than the stone itself. But what our research, the direction of our research, is that we're trying to give glory to the ancient people that lived before us, that they weren't just slave owners or that human beasts of burden, if you will, but the ancient geniuses created their masterpiece to help themselves, not for us, but to help themselves have prosperity. And that's what we want to get across, but we also want to utilize that high technology from that ancient source to help our civilization have a burst of prosperity and a kind of a vision for the future that's a cleaner and safer world.
That's excellent. So have you experienced a lot of opposition to your theories? I know you said the academic world is just like silent, or Egyptologists. Have you had any really aggressive skeptical arguments that you've had to counter?
Actually, other than the experts, the book has been warmly received, and people look at it and they say, it's funny. They usually use this one specific word. They say that the direction of your research is compelling. And we talk about big, heavy payloads that were moved from point A to point B, and the ancients and us were under the same laws of physics, and that type of thing. You know, we had the same strength in our back muscles, if you will. But we've described how the Great Pyramid was built in a method that could actually be done instead of the way Egyptologists do. And people, just regular people, warmly receive it, especially technical people, car mechanics and people that understand a material flow, like in factories, that type of thing. People that understand, that work like in shipyards, that type of thing, that know what it takes to lift very heavy payloads. So we're quite warmly received that way. I thought I'd get a lot of hate email and that type of thing, but from just regular people, it's been very, very good. In fact, sometimes it's the experts who are the last to know.
Wow. Now, I was going to ask a question, but I forgot it was, so I'll just let Pat move on, and I'll think of it, and I'll ask it. Go ahead, Pat.
Well, if the experts are the last to know, is that because they're so close-minded to other ideas?
Well, yeah. Actually, yes, but another way to put it is that they have preconceived notions. You know, if I'm a hammer, then the whole world would be a nail, is one way to put it. They found an artifact called the Piltdown Skull. All the experts instantly accepted it as a missing link. It was found about 1 mile from Darwin's back door. Anyway, come to find out, there was file marks on the jaw and the skull, and the skull was from a human, the jaw was from an ape. It was a forgery, but the experts accepted it instantly because that was their preconceived notion. And it took the experts 40 years to notice the file marks on it. But what actually happened was in 40 years' time, all the people that accepted the Piltdown Skull and wrote their theses on it and their books, all those people died. And then the next generation of experts said, oh, no, the Piltdown Skull, that's a forgery. But it's interesting to note that nobody changed their minds. So we're waiting for quite a few Egyptologists to die off, I guess.
That's a shame, actually. Now, what's your theory about why this technology, since it's so awesome, why was it lost? How can something like that just disappear?
Oh, it's easy. That's easy. Let's say the Great Pyramid operated automatically, like a refrigerator. And it was fully automatic with check valves and that type of thing inside of it. Let's say it ran great for 50 years. Well, everyone that built it or understood how it worked passed away, but the next generation enjoyed the benefits of it. Well, then when it broke, then what do we do? You know, like if everyone that worked in hydroelectric plants passed away, it'd be hard to keep those things running. So that's a possibility. Another one is that there was a sudden catastrophe that occurred that this technology was pre-catastrophe, if you will. And if the civilization crumbled because of political reasons or because of plague or whatever, then the technology to run the Great Pyramid would have been lost. We live in a highly technical world, and we rely on technical people to keep things going. So we'll kind of understand it in a experiential way if our civilization, the technology crumbles, and then we'll see how hard it will be to rebuild it.
And your foundation offers a scholarship. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we have a scholarship from our foundation. It's a $50,000 scholarship where people can quarry or make 5 casing stones the way Egyptologists say they were made. You can find out how they said it was made in any book in any library, and then move them like on and off a barge, and then move them about 100 yards and set them a row of 3 and then the 2 on top, casing stones. And then you get $50,000.
So if you prove that that's correct, but the chances are they can't, right?
Well, they haven't yet. I'm trying to force them to come out of the 17th century and maybe force them clear up to the 19th century and use the scientific method. They say how it was done. They are experts. Why can't they simply make some casing stones? Now, remember, they say a stone was moved and set in place 1 stone every 2 minutes. So we're talking about 10 minutes work. And that's open to Egyptologists, universities, or private citizens, anybody on the whole face of the earth. And they can look at our website at thepump.org for more information about that scholarship. So what I'm trying to say with that scholarship is a way to say that Egyptologists have all these books and all these libraries, but they're incorrect. There's a movement to take falsehoods out of textbooks in a number of states, and we're going to start with the Egyptologists, too.
That wouldn't be such a bad thing, taking falsehoods out of textbooks.
Of course, then the books would be pretty empty. But I have a question. In ancient times, they usually passed on their knowledge, either usually verbally, to the next generation and so on, and so that every generation would have at least a few people that had that knowledge. So what happened? And they didn't do that.
Well, ultimately, yes, it was lost, and it only takes one generation to do that, to lose that knowledge. A good example is on Easter Island. There's writings on Easter Island, but they cannot be read by anybody. And that's because, evidently, at least one generation passed that for some reason that literacy was not carried on. And certainly high technology literacy wasn't carried on either in ancient times. And there's a lot of things that they did in ancient times that were very high tech that we're just now discovering now. Terrapanning, where they do brain surgery in the South America. There's skulls that show that there was brain surgery, and they could tell that the area tried to or started to heal. In other words, the person survived. That's kind of a high technology. Ancient Egyptians did C-sections and also birth control and a whole number of things that we are redeveloping those technologies in the 19th and 20th century. South America has plants that most of our medicines are derived from. Here, a doctor would say, take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning. In South America, they say, chew on these leaves and call me in the morning. So they had, and that's what aspirin is from, is leaves down in a plant from South America. So there's all kinds of high technologies. So, certainly some are lost, and also it takes a whole nother civilization to relearn some of them. But we think at our foundation that there are technologies that are still lost that need to be understood that will help us in modern times.
Now, do you think that there's any kind of documentation in Egyptian writings now, or maybe that hasn't been found, that explains exactly your theories?
Well, we don't. Actually, I'm not sure that Egyptians made the Great Pyramid, ancient Egyptians. It could have been a civilization much earlier than when Egyptologists say the Great Pyramid was built. It exhibits some very high technology that ancient Egyptian civilization doesn't seem to be able to produce. But in terms of documentation, like a manual, no. I don't think anything has survived the millennia from then until now. So we have to look at the Great Pyramid as direct physical evidence, and then to try and reverse engineer that direct physical evidence to redevelop that ancient technology. And I think our foundation is really the only organization that's actually in our mission statement to do just that.
And how large is your foundation right now, and are you looking for other people to participate as regular researchers or anything like that?
Oh, certainly. We have a website, like I say, at thepump.org, and we're looking, now that the book is out, we want to do some YouTube-quality animations, because this is actually quite visual, how the water locks were used and the water and how water went through the Great Pyramid, and it will help a lot. And we want to use those videos to help get the word out, but also to pitch a deal to a network for a documentary. So if somebody wants to be involved in that type of a goal, then they can get a hold of us. Also, we need help on our website, and certainly we need help with anything. People can mention us on Twitter, or they can mention us in forums on the Internet, or tell their friends. They can also put a link from their website to ours. That would help. Being on radio talk shows like this one is a tremendous help. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
But they can visit our website and find out different things they can do to become involved.
Very good. Pat?
So where are your books sold?
It's on Amazon.com or any online bookstore, but also you can go to any bookstore like Barnes & Noble, Borders, and if it's not on the shelf, they can get it for you. So please, I ask people to become familiar with the research and the direction of our research, and a lot of people feel that it has value and there is merit in what we're trying to do. And if they have any questions, they can email us at our website, and our email address is info@thepump.org, or they can even call us. We have a phone number, and that is 541-824-0032.
And what do you think it's going to take to get academics to take a second look at your theories and acknowledge them?
Well, I don't know. That's up to them. But what we're doing is we're just we're doing our own thing here. We're having fun. We're pursuing our interests. And sometimes academics are the last people to catch up. It's the revolutionary people who are on the forefront of discovery. Nikola Tesla was one, but also Wagner, who figured out the continental drift. He had a theory of continental drift, and he was a climatologist. But all the geologists says, "Oh no, we can't have continental drift. We can't have that." So then, a generation later, they figured out plate tectonics, which was the same thing. So we're not worried about the experts. We're just trying to we're worried about the truth.
That's awesome. Now, can you tell us? Are you working on any similar projects at the moment? Do you plan on writing another book?
Oh yeah, we're actually research is ongoing, and there's a lot involved. Certainly, I'm working on another book. You can't write just one book about the Great Pyramid, so I'm doing that. Also, the documentary that we're pursuing. We're going to do another research trip to Egypt, and if anyone wants to be involved in that, they can get a hold of us. And just a whole host of other things. Also, doing our on-site research here at the facility to redevelop this ancient technology, and just all kinds of stuff. So come to our website and find out what we're all about.
Outstanding. We appreciate you being on the show with us tonight. Can you repeat your website one more time for our listeners?
Yeah, our website is at thepump.org. thepump.org.
All right, and definitely when you have the documentary out or you do some future projects, we'd love to have you back on the show.
Oh, I thank you for that. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot. Pat?
We're nearing the top of the hour, and it's time to close this episode of ICE's Paranormal Radio. But before we do, we want to thank Stephen Myers for joining us tonight. Thank you so much. We also invite you to tune in next weekend on Saturday, 8 p.m., when we interview priestess Claudia Williams about her book, Haunted Spaces, Public Places. And on Sunday at 6 p.m., we will be interviewing S.D. Hintz.
Yep, S.D. Hintz.
About his novel, Blood Orchard. Don't miss it. Until next time, have a grand night. Good night and merry parts.
Good night and merry parts.
Paranormal Radio.